I need a plan, Stan. Get off the bus, well, Gus.
I can think of a few things to get off of, too, to get all this stuff done.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast, where HIPAA and humor collide to make learning fun. Your delightful hosts are Donna Grindle and David Sims. Relax. HIPAA help is on the way.
Well, good afternoon, Donna.
Hello, David.
How's it going?
We're going along. Moving along well.
Good. Because today we're going to dive into a multi-part episode. Actually, the first multi-part episode we've had. And we're going to cover 10 misconceptions or myths around HIPAA. We could probably do a podcast about hundreds of misconceptions, but we're going to narrow that down to 10 that we deal with a lot. I know I deal with them in with my clients and people I come across and members, and I'm sure you do the same. And because these are things that's going to be difficult to break down, we'll go into detail about some of them in future podcasts, I'm sure. But to just dive into what some of these are and to give the listeners an idea of why these are misconceptions, I figured we could just pick 10 and go from there. So let's see if we can maybe hit the first three today, and then we will do the next podcast on the next three and maybe top it off with the last four. How's that sound?
Well, that sounds like a plan, David.
Let's roll. Okay. So the first misconception is that providers are not allowed to share information about a patient with others unless authorized by the patient to do so. Is that true or false?
That's mostly false. They have an initial authorization that you have to get when the patient comes in to see you. And a patient can ask for limitations. But as a general rule, once the patient has come in and filled out their paperwork and done all the standard work, then a provider has some flexibility to share information as long as it's in the best interest of the patient or in the in the process of doing business, like for treating the patient or getting payment or running their business, there's certain things that they don't have to get additional authorization from the patient. So the patient could say, this is a caregiver, and from that point forward, the doctor could just talk to them. Or if the somebody's always coming with you to your appointments and sitting in the room, there's kind of an implied consent there. It's always about what's in the best interest of a patient. One good discussion about that was the Ebola madness that took place in the summer 2014. And they're releasing all of this information in the media, you know, the patient's name, what their status is, where they are. We're even watching them get out in their little white suits and barely able to walk their way into the hospital here in Atlanta where they were being treated. And there was a lot of discussion about, well, wait a minute, what about their privacy rights? What about that? And sometimes if it's directly relevant to the people around, then it's okay. So when the whole family had been exposed in the case in Texas, they had to tell everybody that had been exposed, you have the potential and we have to put you in quarantine.
So the, what is it? The good of the many outweigh the needs of the few.
Yeah. And you have to do what's right for the patient. And if the patient can always object and say, I don't want you to tell them. But if the patient never tells you that, yes, while my husband or boyfriend comes with me to every obstetrician appointment when I'm pregnant and they're in there for every single discussion, yet you want something kept private, you have to tell the physician that, or they're going to have, you know, a certain level of implied consent because they're always there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So HIPAA doesn't say, oh, you can't talk to anybody. And I hate more than anything when somebody uses, well, I can't do that because of HIPAA. I can't take care of that for you because of HIPAA. And it's just not true. HIPAA has a lot of nuances and different environments, and most people just use it as an excuse so that they don't have to even deal with any potential decisions, and that's just wrong.
So what about in, you know, we talked a little bit about the Ebola thing. What about when it comes down to reporting things? Like, let's say if somebody went into the hospital with, you know, marks on them, or took a kid into the hospital, and that hospital personnel has to contact law enforcement. I mean, that doesn't violate their HIPAA rights either. Is that correct?
Right, because it's, again, has to do, there's a certain level where it becomes in the best interest of the patient for them to notify authorities, and law enforcement has a certain ability to override HIPAA in some areas. But that doesn't mean just because you're a police officer, you can come in and get all the details about a patient at any time. You know, if there's a car accident and they don't know who the person is, they can't get an identification, there's a lot of things that take place trying to make sure it's in the best interest of the patient for someone to be notified that this is happening. And that's what becomes the most important thing. It is very complex, but if you can show within reason that it's in the best interest of the patient to tell, or even in some cases not to tell, because there's some cases in mental health areas where it's best that the patient doesn't, you know, they don't know what you're seeing about them because it could set them off or cause problems or those kind of things. So sometimes it's in the best interest of the patient to not tell someone, and maybe even not tell the patient what is in their medical records.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So are we ready to go to number two, or you?
I'm good with this.
You good with that?
Yeah. Okay. It's false.
It's false. Because I know we're going to dive in a lot of these deeper later. So yeah. I wanted to, just for the sake of time, jump over into some of the other ones. Okay. So the second myth we're going to cover is the security risk analysis is optional for small providers and business associates. So is that true or false?
Well, the definition of a myth, and because we're covering a myth, is a widely held but false belief or idea. So we're going to go with it's false. David, what do you think?
I don't even understand how people can misconstrue that as being optional. I really don't. It blows my mind.
And why do you have a problem? Why do you see it so obvious? I just want to hear, you know, I know why I see it's obvious. Why do you see it's obvious?
Well, when I look at the regulation, I mean, right out beside it, it says required. It doesn't say optional, or unless you're a small provider, or unless you're a business. I mean, it's required.
Yeah. Well, the law says that all covered entities and business associates must follow the security rule. And like the first element in the security rule of what is required is a security risk analysis. So this idea of I'm too little, or it's only for covered entities and not business associates, I can just do my stuff. It's just wrong. And there are so many people that don't even understand they're supposed to do one, much less have one, or understand how to have one. Mm-hmm. So it is a huge misconception.
Right. I think maybe sometimes, I'm just talking from my experience, sometimes it doesn't make sense to certain business associates when they don't understand how patient information necessarily flows through their business. For instance, in my IT company, we don't have PHI that flows through our business at all, but we come across PHI, we have access to PHI, it just doesn't actually flow through our network. And so I could see where somebody can look at it and say, I don't really understand where the security risks are because we don't store it, we don't have it actually coming through our systems and all that. I can see where that might be a misconception, but I'm still having to stretch it.
Well, but when you look at what is required, and you're supposed to be able to identify anything that could prevent or affect the CIA, as I call it, the confidentiality Mm-hmm. What's the
integrity?
Huh?
and the variability.
Yeah. Way to go, Dave.
So I got it. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I see that definitely. And it's, I guess sometimes you, when you know something as well as we do, it's hard to understand how other people can't understand that.
Right. Yeah. Cause they, you know, so, they'll say, well, we, yeah, that's the classic one. We don't store PHI. Well, mm-hmm. okay. If you have persistent access to PHI, how can PHI integrity be affected or confidentiality be affected or even the availability be affected because your policies and procedures didn't anticipate or even plan for something that could allow an individual to do something that would break down the policies and procedures that your clients think you have in place. So it's all about right. a risk analysis is all about thinking, where do I have things that I need to protect and how can things go wrong?
Right.
And all of the rest of the security rule is kind of based on the answers to that analysis.
Mm-hmm. So the analysis, just in very elementary terms, that analysis is to look at where the PHI is created, how it flows through your practice or business, and maybe how it even flows out of that and goes somewhere else, and how you can protect every single point in and out and being created and even being destroyed, the whole thing. And, you know, from the whole life cycle of that PHI needs to be looked at.
Or the access to it.
Right.
You know, because especially when you look at not just like an IT company where you're talking about, but, you know, we have people who say, well, I don't have to do any of that because my EMR is in the cloud.
Oh, gosh. That's a whole nother episode. Yeah, that's actually a big problem. And we are seeing more and more about that one thing where, you know, people are coming out in some of the blogs and forums and really warning against that. You know, if your EMR provider is telling you that because you're with their solution, then you're done. You know, we take care of HIPAA for you. That's not the case. They may take care of a portion of HIPAA, but there's nothing or no one that's going to take care of every part of HIPAA for you.
Right. And your risk analysis is how you figure that out.
Right.
So that's why it's not optional.
All right. So we'll have to check that one off as false.
Yes. Another falsehood in our list of myths.
All right. So let's roll on to number three. A checklist will suffice for the risk analysis requirement. So would you say that is true or false?
False. It is false.
Hmm. So why can you not just use a checklist? That doesn't make any sense to me, Donna.
Well,
of course, I'm being crazy when I say that, but yeah, that's actually a question we get a lot.
Yeah. A checklist are elements that can be used to inform your risk analysis. But to simply do a checklist doesn't identify all the pieces and parts that need to be involved. If you look at the OCR guidance on what a risk analysis involves, there's three main elements. You identify where PHI is created, received, maintained, or transmitted within your office and your organization. So you're looking at not only what you're storing when you think about like your main storage, but also places like, is it downloaded to individual machines? Is it stored on USB drives? Is it on mobile devices? Is it in the cloud? And you identify where all of that is. That's step number one. And then you look at what are all the human, electronic, and environmental threats to that PHI that I can dream up. And no matter how obscure it is, if you've got it down and then you say, you know what, we've evaluated that, but we are going to accept that risk because we think it's so low. It's the kind of documentation you're supposed to do, is to show you've thought about it. You review then all of the things you're currently doing and say, okay, here's all the PHI we have and here's all the things we can imagine that could go wrong. What are we doing to make sure that we mitigate the things that could go wrong that we've identified as something we should worry about, not just something we should ignore. So you can't do that in a checklist, or at least I couldn't. Could you?
No. I mean, I think we can use a checklist to, you know, just to make sure things are being done, but, you know, certainly applying it to the whole of the regulation is not going to happen.
Right. So just to do the risk analysis, you could have a checklist of places for you to evaluate whether or not you have PHI to worry about. And that'd be great, but you better make sure you've thought through others. And you could have a checklist of elements that could go wrong, but you better make sure you've thought about things. You know, if I get a checklist, you know, here I'm in the South and I make a checklist for my organization, I'm not going to worry about a roof falling in from snow. I'm just not.
You live in Texas, you might want to worry about floods right now.
Yeah, you know, and the flooding and where my office is. And you know what? If my office sits at a dead-end intersection, so a street ends right in front of my windows, I should probably consider a car coming through that window as things that could go wrong. So it's a checklist that you just buy somewhere, doesn't know your environment. And that's a big reason that you can't just pull that checklist out from somebody gave you, because you need to evaluate your environment and what you're doing in your business. And I can assure you, no two businesses function the exact same way. I mean, no two people within the same office even read their email the same way. And we all know that.
In your experience, when people have looked at those three elements of confidentiality, integrity, and availability, do you find that one or at least one of those is a little harder for somebody to grasp? In other words, they may say, okay, I understand how to protect the availability, but I don't understand how to protect the integrity. What does that mean? Do you see that?
Yeah, sometimes, because you're right. People will just say, oh, well, I'm supposed to worry about fire, flood, and all of those kind of things. And that's availability, and they can see that. And confidentiality makes a lot of sense. But integrity matters when you look at things like, let's some specific risk to the integrity would be, can a person go in and change the data that would create a risk to a patient because they've updated it in a way that they shouldn't be allowed to do? Do I have controls to keep people that aren't clinical from putting in clinical information, for example? Do I have controls to make sure if people are entering the clinical information, there's some checks and balances to it, whether it's in the application or something where I can always go back to a separate record to see what was really taken at that time? Do I have multiple checks and balances? And then another really important thing that can happen is, if I'm not backing it up properly and my database gets corrupted, there I have lost the integrity, because maybe I can get part of it back, but now I'm not sure I got all of it back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a lot of ways that even just a single record or row within a table can get damaged in computers. It happens. So now, Right. Now I've blown the integrity of the PHI. So there's a lot of different ways that now I can't trust the data. And that's the bottom line of what you should think about with integrity is, I need to be sure that what I'm looking at here is the right information about the patient so that I can treat them properly.
Yeah. And there's tools that are out there. You know, just recently I was exposed to a tool that is able to kind of look at what users are doing within the EMR system, no matter what system you're in.
Yep.
And be able to tell whether or not there's anomalies there and maybe things they shouldn't be doing. So there's certainly ways to use other software and other tools to help you look at that. Otherwise, it would be difficult, if not impossible, for some of these smaller organizations and even, you know, hospitals to really dig in and see what people are doing without having something that was going to alert them of an anomaly.
Well, yeah, and that's exactly why you and I are constantly evaluating tools so that we're able to advise people. And there's a wide world out there of information for tools and vendors, and there's just so much. There's so much to look at. And sometimes, yeah, that's perfect, but its price structure is designed for a big hospital. Or, yeah, that's perfect, but it doesn't scale to a big hospital. It scales to a large provider clinic. So those are a lot of things that we get a chance to look at, and that's why we're able to find the vendors and find the solutions and advise our customers on this is a good fit for your environment, for the price, the type of solution. It'll give you the pieces you need. So it's a helpful way to make sure that we can go out there and find the things that will help you maintain the confidentiality, integrity, and availability, which is part of what you turn around and do when you identify these risks of things that can go wrong. You have to figure out, well, if I'm going to accept the risk that I'm not going to really do anything, but somebody at a high level better say I'm accepting the risk and we've agreed, I can outsource the risk. I can pass that off to somebody else. So the risk of a firewall getting attacked, okay, I'm going to push that out to a vendor. Well, what vendor should I use? Oh, I don't know. Maybe I should use David because he knows about HIPAA and he knows how to do it right and he can pass a BA due diligence questionnaire. You can outsource it, but everything else, you have to have a plan. So if I can't outsource it and I think that it's something that's reasonable that could happen, then I need to have a plan. And that's what the whole compliance program and security program and doing your risk analysis is all about. I need a plan, Stan. Get off the bus, well, Gus.
I can think of a few things to get off of too to get all this stuff done.
Yeah.
But okay. Well, we covered our first three. And so we'll dive into the next ones on the next episode. So is there anything else you want to talk about on those three we covered?
No, I think we've rambled enough.
No, that was awesome information. That was great. So very good. Well, I want to remind everyone who's listening, helpmewithhipaa.com is our website. And we'd also love for you to go over to iTunes and give us a review. And, you know, even though we'd love to have a 5-star review, we do ask that you be honest and, you know, let us know what you think about it. Also, you can hit us up on our website and let us know what you think about the episode and communicate with us there as well.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Give us a question on there.
Yeah, absolutely. Do that. And we'll cover your question in a future episode. All right, Donna. Well, until next time, I'll talk to you later.
You betcha. See ya, David.
You've been listening to the Help Me with HIPAA podcast, hosted by Donna Grendel and David Sims, the show created to help you with HIPAA. For more information or to ask us a question, visit our website at helpmewithhipaa.com. Neither Donna Grendel or David Sims are attorneys, and they do not offer binding legal advice concerning regulatory compliance. The information in this podcast should not be relied upon or construed as legal advice in any way. Consult your attorney for legal advice concerning compliance with HIPAA regulations.